Welcome to the Washington Independent Review of Books podcast. I'm Susan Storer Clark, and today we'll be talking with Carrie Brown, whose seventh novel, The Stargazer's Sister, centers on the life of Caroline Herschel. Herschel worked with her famous brother William, who discovered the first new planet since ancient times, and he also did pioneering work in spectrophotometry. Caroline, also called Lena, was not only his devoted assistant, but she did some pioneering work of her own. She discovered 8 comets. 6 of those are named for her. And she was the first woman that we know about who was paid for her work as a scientist. Carrie Brown, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Caroline Herschel led an extraordinary life. Was it just hearing about her life that planted the seed for this novel, or was it something else?
I first heard about the Herschels thanks to the radio program Stardate, which is produced by the McDonald Observatory in Austin, Texas. And I was struck by how unusual and how complex the relationship between this brother and sister, Caroline and William, must have been, certainly for its time, but also just in general. I think many novels begin this way. With curiosity about someone's life or their circumstances. And as soon as I began wondering about them, and especially about Caroline, whose experience, because she was a woman, was in some ways even more remarkable than her remarkable brother's, I was immediately caught and held fast. Her story is really truly extraordinary.
Well, and it starts out in an extraordinary way. There was a large brood of brothers and sisters, and her mother treated her almost like a servant, refusing to educate her very much. And it looked as though Lena was going to be stuck there waiting on her mother for the rest of her life. But William went off to England and made his fortune and came back and rescued her. But then he married at the age of 50, and he moved his wife in and his sister out. At which point she feels betrayed and bitter. Did this twist on the fairy tale rescue part attract you too?
It did. That's a great way of describing it. And I think I was interested from the beginning, really, in the different kinds of expectations that William and Caroline had for each other because of their relative experience in the world, because William was older and he was a man, and how that imbalance between them sort of played a role in their emotional relationship. I was struck by the fact that precisely because William rescued her, indeed Caroline, I think, would have led a very unhappy and lonely life had he not done so. Because he rescued her, she was really forever in his debt, and that's a complicated circumstance to have at the heart of a relationship. No matter what she did for him, I think in some ways it would probably never equal, at least in her mind, what he did for her. And she would always be dependent on him, while he would always have his independence and his authority in the world. So, you know, this is not new terrain for women, of course, and it's not new terrain even for novels about women. But I was intrigued by that difficulty at the heart of their relationship. That's the kind of complexity I think that writers are drawn to. And as I learned about them, I was equally intrigued not just by that difficulty, but also by the way in which their relationship succeeded. I mean, despite, I think, that kind of imbalance between them. So they were both a product of their times, but they also broke free of many of the kind of unwritten and unspoken rules that govern relationships between men and women. And I think they were really both rule breakers in their own way.
There are some amazing scenes in there. William stayed out all night looking at the stars. It's pretty much what you have to do if you're going to be a full-time astronomer. And Lena would feed him like a little bird. She took extraordinary care of him, didn't she?
She did take extraordinary care of him. The book, I think, for me in the end, really became so much about not just work. Their work was fascinating work, but also about how it is that we love people even through the sort of difficult stretches in a relationship. And Lena's absolute devotion to him was pretty amazing to witness. She knew, I think, from the very start, even when she was a child, she sensed that her older brother was going to do extraordinary things in the world, and she wanted very much to help him become that extraordinary person. I don't think she ever imagined that she would become an extraordinary person in the course of that service, but she certainly did.
Their accomplishments are just dazzling. Not only did they both break through in astronomy, but they were, William was a successful musician when he brought Lena to England. She became a successful solo singer in his concerts. And I have to say, it was kind of amazing to me that in those days one would use music to support science. It doesn't work that way very much anymore. But
no, of course not.
How important was music in their lives, and how important was it in your story?
Well, you know, I think it was very important. I mean, as you say, it was the method by which William supported himself for a long time. Nobody was going to pay him to be an amateur astronomer. And I think music also appealed to William and to Caroline as well, in part because they had some native gifts for it. But also because, I mean, William was such a polymath. The guy could do anything, really. And I think a lot of the sort of ways in which music is structural, some of the formulas and patterns and even sort of mathematics associated with music are not such distant cousins to the mathematics behind astronomy. So I think that there was probably some crossover there for William. Somebody pointed out to me recently that even though, you know, William's music is sort of part of the classical era, that he was interestingly a composer whose music was not especially forward-thinking. He was sort of on the cusp of the Romantic era, but his music does not break pattern or break tradition from the composers who preceded him. It was really fascinating to me that he was a kind of traditionalist as a composer, whereas he was a sort of revolutionary in terms of astronomy. It was a really fascinating thing for me to discover.
And you write about, it was very vivid to me when Lena realized that the sky was not a great bowl overhead.
Yeah.
You know, which was the way people thought of it. And you capture particularly well the exaltation that comes from gazing at the stars. Now, this breakthrough about the bowl, it's really a bowl that William Herschel shattered in a way, isn't it, to make us realize that space extends onward far beyond anything we can see?
He absolutely did. That's a wonderful description of it. The actual words that were engraved on his tombstone, his gravestone, were in Latin, but the translation is he broke through the barriers of the heavens. And indeed, I think he really did do that. And he had the imagination to realize that people at that time were limited by the technology available to them. They kind of assumed that what they could see was all there was to see. And he just intuited that the problem was the tools, that in fact there was a great deal more to be seen if only he could design and build the tools with which to see at a greater distance. And he was, I think, exhilarated.
You describe very well the exaltation people feel looking at the stars. Have you spent some time doing that, maybe even with some modern equipment?
I have. Not actually very much. When I began researching the novel, I was able to have access to the observatory at the University of Virginia, which has some public viewing hours every couple of weeks for people who want to come up and look through the telescopes. And I made it a regular practice for a while to go up and make a nuisance of myself with the graduate students up there. After a while, I couldn't skulk around up there anymore. I'm sure they were, you know, ducking and running for cover when they saw me. But I think it is a kind of awesome thing to stand outside on a dark night and look up at the sky. It's beautiful, and just to kind of contemplate what's up there, what's out there, is really deeply engrossing and awe-inspiring. I don't remember who said it, but somebody sort of described the human mind as longing to be engaged with something larger than it can compass, which I think is true often of the human imagination, and it was certainly true for William and for Lena, that, you know, standing outside at night and looking up at the stars, he just longed to know what was up there, and Lena at his side, I think, longed to know it as well.
Now, you've written several historical novels, but this is the first one in this period, the late 18th and early 19th century. It gives a reader a vivid sense of everyday life. You've mentioned Lena's journals. I presume those were sort of the foundation of your research, but tell us a little bit about those and maybe what other sorts of research you did.
Lena's journals absolutely were invaluable to me. I think anybody writing a historical novel is lucky if they stumble upon a subject who kept such detailed records about her own life. And they really allowed me to see not just the larger picture of her life, but also the kinds of, you know, quotidian, ordinary details that that make a life seem real and vivid and true for a writer who's trying to recreate that experience. So I relied very heavily on her diaries and her day books and her journals and then her memoirs later. You know, and there's just tons and tons and tons written about that particular era in astronomy because it was so explosive with Herschel really leading the way in many respects. Her journals were of real interest to me. They weren't especially confessional or really even narrative in the way we might think about a diary today. They were just full of practical recordings of comings and goings and events and worries about money and worries about William's health. He was very worried about William's health. I think they were sick a lot. And if you stand outside, you know,
yeah,
all night long in the coldest of weather, you're going to end up getting sick, as they did. But every now and then she would offer a sort of bit of commentary on her life. She was quite wry and dry, and she certainly was not without opinions about what was going on. So, you know, the journals were an amazing resource.
The book opens showing her as a young girl in Hanover, which is northern Germany, and she's feeling the effects of the 1755 earthquake in Lisbon. It was centered in Portugal. And you have her visiting Lisbon as an old woman, and I don't see that in the sort of Wikipedia biographies I've read. What is the importance of the Lisbon earthquake to the fictional Lena, and what's the significance of Lisbon to her?
That's a wonderful, wonderful question. The earthquake was amazing. Lena did in fact feel the tremors of that 1755 earthquake in Lisbon. It was one of her earliest memory. She was 5 years old at the time, and the novelist in me loved that detail, that an astronomer's memory begins with this sort of bizarre and frightening awareness that the planet she's standing on is not exactly terra firma. It just felt metaphorically significant for a person who ends up devoting her life to exploring the universe and to understanding both the ways in which it's constantly in motion and also the inherent tension between its fixed relationships, planets, you know, in predictable orbit, for example. So I felt the kind of gravitational pull of that earthquake as a novelist, and it's why I wanted to have Lena touch ground in Lisbon late in her life, although that's an invented journey and relationship in the novel. But, you know, that's why I write novels and not biographies. Life is not necessarily artful, though it may be fascinating. But as a novelist, I'm interested in how to shape the material of a life, you know, real or imagined for artful purposes. So that earthquake just felt to me like a detail that was worth pursuing.
You say this is why you write novels and not biographies. William died a long time before she did, and she went... Did she not go back to Germany? Isn't that what she did?
She did. In fact, I wanted very much to be, you know, to have some fidelity to that truth, because I think it was important that at the end of her life, she could not really imagine anything other than going back to Hanover after having had this extraordinary partnership with her brother. I think the grief into which she was sunk after his death was profound. I think she wrote to a friend, and I think this is in the novel, you do not know the blank of life after having lived within the radiance of genius. And I, you know, that reading that line of hers, it just felt like, you know, somebody had swung a 2x4 at my chest. That the degree of grief I think that she felt was, as I say, it was profound. It seems like, you know, today a sort of mental health professional would say to her, no, don't go do that. Don't go back to Hanover. It's going to be lonely. And what are you going to do? You've led this, you know, fascinating life and you've got work still to do. Don't leave. But I think there was nobody around maybe to say that to her exactly, or maybe they were afraid to say that to her, or maybe they did say it and she ignored them. In any case, she took herself back to Hanover very shortly after William's death and really severed her ties with England. How to understand that emotionally? I mean, I think that for me was at the core of the novel at the core of trying to understand this woman who sacrificed her life in so many ways for her brother. That sacrifice gave her a tremendous amount. She certainly profited by it in terms of her own experience. But then that mysterious question, why give it all up? Why retreat from the world? The only explanation I could imagine is that her grief was so great, and that maybe in some way, by going back to her childhood, to William's childhood, she was perhaps imagining that she could have a kind of reunion there with him, obviously not in the literal sense, but that she could recapture a time when she wasn't sharing him with the whole world.
Well, is there a question I haven't asked you that I should have asked you? Is there something else you'd like to say about the Stargazer's sister?
Oh, thank you. Well, I think not, you know, but I do want to say that it is an amazing experience. It was an amazing experience for me to be companioned by Lena, or to have her in my life for so many years. I worked on the novel for a long, long time, and I think it's a real privilege for a novelist to be able to open up, you know, the vault of somebody's life and to try to understand what they lived through. Even now, when I go back and dip into her diaries or her correspondence, you know, even though the novel is finished, she was my companion for a long time. I can't exactly just put her aside. I see things that I didn't notice before, and you know, my sympathy and admiration for her just really continued to grow over the years that I worked on the novel, and it was a great privilege.
Well, thank you, Carrie Brown. Carrie Brown is the author of The Stargazer's Sister. Thank you, the listener, for joining us on the Washington Independent Review of Books podcast. I'm Susan Storer Clark.